All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Really glad to see you all. We are today combining some different classes and colleagues attending a talk here by Matt Carlson in our Digital Journalism Focus Seminar Series. And Matt Carlson, for those of you who are not familiar with him, is what we usually say as a world-renowned scholar in the area of journalism studies. He used to be the chair for ICA, has won awards for his research, namely the Outstanding Article Award and other awards. He will today present research much based on one of his recent books on journalistic authority and two articles, one recently published on mechanical objectivity and automated journalism and photojournalism, and one forthcoming article for a special issue on epistemology. Matt is the type of scholar who knows a lot, basically, and can talk about anything. And he has a sense in identifying quite different research topics, somewhat ahead of the rest of us. So if you look at his Google Scholar profile, you'll see that he has sort of identified key areas a few years ahead of some other scholars. And, well, yes, you have the floor, Matt. Flying in from Minnesota, we're very happy to see you.
Thank you so much, Oscar. Thank you very much for coming. And now I'm going to have to come up with some good topics that will be popular in the next few years. But I really appreciate this turnout. If you find it boring, you can escape out the window. There's, it looks like a ladder right there. Yes, it's really great to be here. And I'm really thrilled to see like copies of my book here in Norway. It's really exciting when like your work travels farther than you do. And I'm just trying to catch up. So that's always really exciting. So yes, I'm going to be working from the book and talking a little bit about what we get from that perspective of thinking about journalistic authority. What does it get us, right? Part of how I'm doing that is thinking about a couple sort of key ideas that are going on, a couple key conflicts. One is the very classic one of objectivity, subjectivity, and thinking about how that's always a perpetual issue. And I think there's some ways that we can talk about technology in the way that we don't usually talk about objectivity and subjectivity in news. And then I want to talk about distribution and circulation. This is more of a newer issue as technology is changing. I want to think about how news, the experience of news is changing and how that changes journalism's shared meanings, which gets back to journalistic authority. And then the final thing is, you know, the talk today is something about transitioning of journalistic authority. So my final conclusion, I want to talk about transitioning to what? Right? Transition is a very common academic word we like to use. Everything's always in transition. If it wasn't, we wouldn't study it. So where are things going needs to be part of that conversation as we look towards the future. And yes, here are the pieces that I'm talking about today. Yes, and New Media Society, this is coming out soon, Oscar, I hope. Okay, waiting for this one to come out. But you can, the digital journalism's already out. If you're interested in this one, I can send you a copy. But it should be out pretty soon. So I want to start with the book. And you know, the interesting thing about the book is that I wrote most of this book in 2014 and 15. And it already, I feel like things have changed so much since when I wrote it. And when I wrote the book, the whole idea of writing the book was to try to capture a bunch of things I've been thinking about, and to slow down and to look at dynamics in a broad way that we don't often get to do because we're really focused on all the things that are changing all the time, right? So my challenge myself when I wrote the book was, how do I write something that I hope will be valuable even as conditions change, right? Even as the world moves on, that hopefully I can say something and give some perspectives that will be useful irregardless of what those changes look like. I didn't expect to be tested so quickly, but I think things are changing so fast. But the main idea, the real takeaway I want is this idea that journalistic authority is not a thing. It's not a quantifiable metric that's sometimes up and sometimes down. Like, we can give a journalistic authority score and almost like a baseball game or a stock index or something like that. Instead, I want us to think about it as a relationship. And that way it focuses on how that relationships and a bunch of relationships change over time, how they grow, how they evolve. And so journalistic authority can diminish, it could change in different ways, but I don't want to focus on its up or its down right now. And so in doing that, coming up with this, I came up with this definition of journalistic authority. And part of this is based off this fundamental idea of what authority is, right? That authority is a very thorny word that we think about. And a big part of that is that journalists don't really have power, right? They don't have power in the way that the police do, or the courts do, or the military does. They can't force you to read the news or to accept that something's true. It relies instead on these relationships and establishing this idea of having a right to create legitimate discourse of knowledge, right? The right to do something, the right to tell somebody something else is a really special right. As students, you encounter that constantly, right? We have professors tell us things about the world. And so that's what I wanted to get at with this idea. What it means to tell other people that something happened and is true. And so when we think about this, we can also think about what this looks like and what we want it to look like. I don't want to argue that journalistic authority on its own has merit. It's how it's wielded, how these relationships work, what we want them to look like. And so part of what I like about authority as an idea is that I think it pushes us to think about what kinds of authority relationships should be there. And if they're not there, how do we get there? I don't want to say that by itself, journalistic authority is its own good. The second half of the book is really about looking outside of journalism of authority. It's not that journalists can establish their own relations themselves, but they have to establish relationships in concert with these other groups, the sources that they talk to, that they need to get information from, right? The audiences is a big part, right? The audiences that read the news, there's a relationship there. But I also want to include technology, because technology's changed. I'll talk a lot about technology today. And the last one was the final chapter of the book is about critics. And if I could rewrite the book, which I don't think I will, I would have put critics up front. Because I think that is one of the most important parts of how we think about authority, are the people who are constantly criticizing journalism from within, from without, and we'll talk about that some today. So in the end, what happens is the journalistic authority needs to be understood as something that's dynamic, something that's always changing. If we think about relationships always change. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and so I'm constantly reminded of how quickly relationships change between who's her friend, who's not her friend, who's an enemy, and who's the best friend today. And I think that's a good lesson to have, is how these relationships are always changing, and we don't really think about them as stable. So change is really what I'm talking about today. And technology is not the only lens for thinking about change. Certainly other sorts of ideas, economics, policy, those other kinds of realms are important. But technology is really what I want to get on there. And I don't want to be saying everything's driven by technology, but there's this relationship between what's possible, the material possibilities technology enables, and how this leads into the imagining of what these possibilities are. And my favorite quote on this is from James Carey, who's writing about the telegraph here. It's a fantastic chapter. It's in his book, his first book, and it's all about the telegraph. And he describes the telegraph as a thing to think with, an agency for the alteration of ideas, right? The telegraph is the first electrical communication device. It was the first time you can send a message faster than you could carry it, essentially, right? Those possibilities were really important for how people thought about things like time and space and news, commodities, and that's what he captures in the article. And I've always loved that quote, right? That technology is a thing to think with, an agency for the alteration of ideas. Because I think that's true when we study journalism, is to think about journalistic technology as a thing to think with, as something that changes the possibilities that are there. So the issue, though, is that things move fast. James Carey is writing about the telegraph more than a century after the telegraph basically disappeared. And he's able to have all these insights because he's looking back historically. How do we do that in the present when we don't have a historical sense? We are challenged to constantly keep up with what's going on without really having perspective of what's important and what's not important sometimes. So that's a real challenge. So technology to me is important when we think about knowledge. A lot of my work draws on the work of Thomas Guerin, who is a historian of science, and he writes about epistemic authority. And his view is how, he looks at science, so how do scientists establish epistemic authority? How do they establish the authority to say this is a true thing we know from the standpoint of science, and this is not science, right? Epistemic authority, and again, I like it because it allows us to move beyond the text, the object, to the relationships that make something true, right? That knowledge is about the conditions for the production of knowledge. And in terms of journalism, Mats Ekstrom's 2002 piece is just a classic piece of literature. He's looking at television. He's not even looking at digital technologies, per se. But he has this great definition of journalistic epistemology from a pragmatic sense, more than a philosophical sense, right? We're not talking about what is truth and what is knowledge from the sense of a philosophy, but we are looking at from the sense of what are the ways in which journalistic knowledge comes to be, right? And this is tricky because, you know, we're here in a university setting. We have a very high standard for what we think about as knowledge, right? What we think about as something that we know. We work really hard at that. And so news, we have to think about it as sort of an everyday form of knowledge. It's not knowledge in the extensive sense of a lot of scholarship, but it is information about the world, and it does rely on different kinds of social relationships in order to verify that, yes, this account of something has at least enough bearing to the truth that we can take it as that thing actually happened. So those are sort of the key ideas from authority, from the journalistic authority book, from that work, that I want to highlight as we move into thinking about how technology is changing. And I want to start with this idea of the objectivity-subjectivity divide in journalism. Right. So I like Thomas Hannisch's very, very short definition of journalistic authority, the view that one can and should separate facts from values, right? And I like this because it's short, and also because it involves two things. It involves practice, right, that one can separate facts and values, that there is a process for this to happen. But it also involves something beyond practice. It involves norms and ideals of what should be. And this is such a familiar idea within journalism scholarship, within popular understandings of journalism, of objectivity as this goal, right? Of trying to deliver news without having some sort of bias. And it serves a lot of functions. It's a legitimating strategy, first of all. Why should we accept what you're saying? Well, we're following strategies of objectivity to provide news as clearly and as unbiased as we can. It's a political assumption, right? It gets into larger discourses about democracy and information and citizenship and how the news functions within that, right? And the news is really justified a lot about this idea of objectivity, of providing news that people can then use to be citizens, I should say. And then objectivity also shapes news practices and it shapes expectations, right? So if objectivity is a value, then there are lots of strategies to get there, particularly, let's say, quoting strategies, right? That rather than make an assertion, a journalist can find a person to make the assertion, put that in quote marks, and to say, this person says this thing. We have different sides of the issue. We'll get people on both sides doing it. And then the expectations of audiences are shaped by this idea of what a news piece should be, that how it should work. But objectivity is a problem, right? It's not so clearly rendered, right? And for a couple big reasons. I'm going to consolidate them into two. The first is that journalistic facts are not independent of journalists. They're created by journalists. They're known to us through journalism. It's not to say that journalists make up everything, that they're manufacturing reality. It's not exactly that. But it's that only through the work of journalists do we get these facts. There is a human process involved, and so the facts are not independent of that process. They have to be thrown through this process, and that process itself is a construction, and it has different kinds of biases built into it. The second is that objectivity as a goal is, because it is unreachable in sort of the idyllic sense, it always is, opens up journalists for critique. It always leaves them open for accusations of the view from nowhere, that they're just saying these things are true. It also leaves it open to critique that they aren't fulfilling their ideals. So certainly somebody like Donald Trump in the United States, who's constantly criticizing the press, is doing so in a way that he's saying, well, they're not living up to their objective goals and they're being biased against me, which he likes to say all the time. So objectivity, as much as it provides a way for journalists to try to legitimate what they do, it also leaves space open for critique. So that's all very familiar. What does technology have to do with it? And I want to push this discussion forward by moving a little bit from the normative ideas of objectivity, the way we usually talk about it, to technological possibilities. What possibilities technologies have. And I'm going to do that talking about two different things. Photography, a familiar practice, one that has been around for a long time, and then algorithms, which is a newer practice. And so hopefully that looking at both of these provides us some context. And in order to do that, I draw from back to the history of science. There's so many good things that happened in the history and philosophy of science. You know, they've been wrestling with ideas of knowledge and epistemology for a long time. I really like this idea of mechanical objectivity that comes from the book Objectivity from Dastin and Gallison. They are studying almanacs of nature. Right, those kinds of encyclopedias of nature, of like typologies of plants and animals and things like that. That is there, so pretty far removed from like the daily newspaper. But at the same time, the procedures as they talk about them, I think, are really useful. And one of the big ones they use is this idea of the mechanical objectivity, objectivity through the machine, right? Moving nature to the page as if automatically. In general, this is useful in the terms of realm science because we can see this in a lot of ways, right? You know, science is really about technology, right? You know, you look at the history of the Enlightenment and technology, or in science, we think about things like the telescope or the microscope, these kinds of devices that made scientific inquiry possible are really important. And there's also this hope of trying to reproduce the findings from science as mechanically as possible to eliminate human biases, right? So some dovetails there with the journalism. The desire for pure observations unencumbered by humans, is very strong. And this happens overtly, but also implicit. And let me make this a little more concrete in terms of the models that Dastin and Gallison use. The first is truth to nature, the ideal model. Right, so again, they're looking at like encyclopedias of plants. And here we have this ideal of what this plant looks like, the Tupa blanda. It involves artistic license and artistic ability, right? In fact, these things have become art. Right now we cut them up and frame them and put them on our wall. But the scientific idea of this is to create this ideal. Here's the ideal of what this plant looks like, and you have whole encyclopedias. And that stood for a while, but it always involved that movement from nature to through the human hand and interpretation. And that shifts to this idea of mechanical objectivity. This is one of the first pictures ever of a snowflake. Very difficult to capture a snowflake and a photo of it, right? It took a long time to be able to capture, you have to capture a single one and photograph it before it melts. And so here we have a picture of that. And so it's pretty interesting as an artifact of technology being used to make a scientific observation, but it's kind of terrible as an actual illustration of anything, right? It's sort of an evidence of what a snowflake looks like, but it's not that clear, it's a little messed up, and it doesn't really work in terms of creating these atlases that they're trying to do. So mechanical reproduction was this real push towards reproducing real life, but it didn't work. And that actually led to something they called trained judgment, which is combining sort of artisticness a little bit, but trying to also do so in a way that you can reproduce knowledge. These are a map of sunspots. It's not nearly as artistic as the first picture I showed you, but it is demonstrating a certain amount of authority of the scientists to try to map this activity in a way that's useful for other people, the way that the snowflake picture may not be. So professional discernment becomes really important. So I think something is going on here with photojournalism that is actually fairly similar. And here I'm really influenced by Christoph Reisch's piece in 2015 when he looks at the history of early history of photography. And it's really fascinating. So you think about the newspapers. It was pretty easy early on to reproduce text. Text was not hard at all. We've been doing that for hundreds of years. Reproducing photos was way, way more difficult. And for a long time, it was way easier to do wood prints, to do engravings, because those are really easy to stamp out and produce for a newspaper. Photographs took a lot longer. And so even as journalism was moving towards objectivity in news writing, pre-photography involved these interpretive visual modes of trying to interpret the scene artistically into a picture that can be reproduced. And then photography comes along and we get this sort of mechanical objectivity again. And so it took a while for this idea of what Donna Swartz calls seeing is believing to happen, right? Seeing was not believing. It was an interpretation. We knew a woodblock was not the picture. We knew it was an interpretation. And it took a while for the photograph to be developed enough, the technology to reproduce them, that photos became the ultimate bit of evidence, right? In a way that the actual textual account might be seen as removed because it's taking, processing different ideas into a news text to say that this happened. It's very different than here's a photo. The photo happened. And it gets into questions of how we know what we know. Okay, let me make this more concrete with a good picture of a woodcut. This is from newspapers. I forgot what year this is. Sorry about that. But it's a reproduction of an event that actually happened, apparently, where some wedding guests tried to break into these people's hotel rooms, and the wife grabs the gun and shoots them. Did it look exactly like this? Probably not at all. Is this a picture? Yeah, it's like, you know, it's very lascivious, right? It's a chance to show, like, some cleavage there that you wouldn't usually be able to do, but hey, it's a news picture, so that's valuable. I was looking at this. Actually, I wonder, like, I feel like her cloak almost looks like a devil's tail. There's some interpretation in there, maybe. Right? The man being shot, but there's no blood is not splattered all over the wall. It's pretty tame in that sense. But, you know, it's the kind of interpretation of taking an event. Nobody was there drawing a woodcut at the time. It's a reproduction of it. And you can see the importance of visual knowledge. People like this picture for various reasons. But the fact that it was not a photograph It didn't really bother people. People preferred pictures like this. They're entertaining. They gave some idea of how news works. And even after photographs started appearing in news, people still actually preferred these for a while. But eventually the photograph wins out. And we got to remember, the photographs were really bad in newspapers for a very long time. This is from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. This is about Charles Lindbergh after he had come back to the U.S., after he had flown across single-handedly to Paris, comes back. He's a big American hero. And you can see how terrible these pictures are, right? They're very grainy. It's hard to get any details out of them. This one, of course, you have a man in a white suit, so it's really overexposed. Not nearly as useful as the other picture I just showed you, or as enjoyable, but they're photos. They have a certain epistemological qualities to them, that these were taken of things that actually happened. And that takes over as a way of showing truth. And not only truth, but objective truth. Right, the photo is seen as the model that this thing actually happened. Okay, as opposed to the other drawing, which people come to accept finally, it's just an interpretation and probably didn't happen that way. But these are considered to be actual pieces of evidence of something happening. So technology changes how truth can be displayed. You might be thinking in your head, well, what about fakes? There are fakes. As long as it's been photography, there have been photographs that have been staged. This is from the American Civil War. It's called the Death of a Rebel Sharpshooter. And you know, during the Civil War, there's a lot of American Civil War. There's a lot of photographs, but photography back then is a giant carriage, lots of chemicals, and like a minute exposure. So there's no action shots of the Civil War. There's no actual battles, but there's a lot of aftermath shots. And this one is kind of a classic, almost like Renaissance painting with the diagonal lines coming in and the dead soldier at the bottom posed in terms of the camera. Well, they drag the body over there and they set it up to look a certain way. My daughter saw this picture. I told him, he's just sleeping. He's not really dead. But no, he actually is dead. I can tell you all that. But they set it all up to create this aesthetically pleasing image, which became one of the most famous images of the Civil War. And there's a lot of early photography that's like that. And of course, that's before digital pictures. This is a photo taken for the Los Angeles Times by a photographer named Brian Walsky. This is from like 2003 or 4. It's pretty early on in the American War in Iraq. And can you see the problem? Can anybody identify it? This was on the front page of the Los Angeles Times, all the way across, five columns, and in front of a lot of other papers too. Like, it got a lot of play. But can you see the? Anybody spot the? It's like a game. Can you spot the problem? Nobody picked this up at first. It took a while, so the editors didn't pick it up. But okay. This guy appears, and this person appear twice. And this face, too, is turned, but it's the same person. And what happened is he took two images, one with the soldier like this, and then one with this person like this. And so he combined them to make it look more dramatic. The soldier above everybody else, his hand out, the gun there, the father with the child, right? It's a pretty dramatic photo. The photographer in the field on his laptop in the middle of Iraq during a war edits these together, submits it to his editor, and then after it's fired, he gets fired for it. But, you know, we recognize how easy it is in the digital world to take photos, and so we lose some of this idea of, you know, seeing is believing. But yet, we really do value mechanical objectivity as a way of verifying that something happened. You know, we want to see that these things happen. And this has led to a tension within photojournalism. How much credit does the journalist get? Is the photojournalist there as a professional, or is it just the camera doing the work? Right? If you know photojournalists, you say, well, yes, photojournalists are very, very tough people who are out there subjectively working to take pictures. But yet, we still value the picture itself a lot of the times. And there's been a lot of difficulties in a lot of places about recognizing photojournalists as journalists on par with other journalists because they're sometimes seen as mechanics using a camera as opposed to the more interpretive work of the journalists assembling material together. So this difficulty persists a lot because of this idea of mechanical objectivity. And I've already talked about digital pictures. So objectivity, subjectivity with images, we tend to privilege images once they become, once we're able to circulate them in news texts. I think a similar thing's happening with algorithms and the use of algorithms in news. We think about algorithms as decision-making tools, right? As an input that gives us, you put data in as an input, you get an output, decisions are made. Because they're formulas, right? Because they're code, a lot of times what happens is what Gillespie says is we have the technologically inflected promise of mechanical neutrality, right? It's just the algorithm. The algorithm can't lie. The algorithm just takes the data and it processes it. It doesn't know what it's processing. It's just a code, right? And Sundar calls this the machine heuristic, that we tend to make a shortcut in our mind that because it's produced by a machine, therefore it must be seen as something that's more objective. But of course, there's a lot of work in algorithm studies. Science. So this gets used a lot in science. This idea that the promise of big data, that we can take large amounts of data sets and we can produce knowledge that's way better than human judgment because we can't, our little brains can't process as much as an algorithm can. And all that leads to a separation between the human and the algorithm. So the problem there, of course, is that algorithms are not naturally derived things. They are produced in context by people. Bias slips in a lot of different ways. That's become more and more apparent. I'll talk about that in a second. What we're seeing is a lot of ways in which news algorithms are sneaking into journalism in a lot of ways. And this sort of this hope of the computer, right? I think we see a reactivation of this debates around objectivity now that we have these kinds of processes where the machine is considered to be neutral compared to humans who are always subjective. So the dream of the robot is it doesn't have any feelings, so it can give us a more unbiased view of the world. And algorithms are everywhere, right? What stories get recommended to us, how content is personalized, how we analyze all this data that journalists use to write stories, so they're able to use a lot of different kinds of algorithms in the production of news. Even in writing stories, right, that we have software that can take data and write a news story with it. Even audience metrics and feedback, the kinds of data that come out about what people are reading what. So I see mechanical objectivity as very important for analyzing this algorithmic news world and the assumptions that go in about how these things work. The assumptions that we can turn things over to machines and it will be more objective than humans. Right? That humans are always subjective, that machines are always human. And I think that is something that we see in discourses about algorithms. It also raises questions about how these kinds of tools become what I'm calling epistemic actors, right? They become knowledge producing. And I mean this in two different senses. First of all, the algorithms are made to fit existing models of news, right? They come in programmed with the already assumptions of journalism there, including normative understandings of how what news should be and what it should look like. So algorithms fit what these models are. At the same time, algorithms can change how we imagine news. So two quick examples. So the first one would be automated journalism. This idea that the computer program can write a news story. It's being used in the U.S. It's being used to write sports stories, right, based off sports data. So it can write stories about all kinds of different teams that maybe it's not worth sending a journalist to write. But if you have the data, the story can be spit out pretty quickly by a computer program. It's also being used a lot in stock reporting. So public companies have their quarterly earnings reports that come out. These are pretty cut and dry. Here's a bunch of numbers about how much the stock's gone, like what the sales are, et cetera, et cetera. Only a few of these get turned into actual stories, but automated journalism can take this structured data and can spit out stories that way. So there's some, we're seeing more and more uses where there's data that there's uses of automated journalism. And in some sense, the argument that the proponents of this make is that these stories are going to be unbiased because the program is just taking this data and spitting out a story. But actually what's interesting about that is how much these stories are based off of pre-existing models. The whole point of it is to look like human journalism and not be able to tell the difference about it. And a lot of the data says that, yeah, people have trouble telling the difference between a story written by an algorithm and a story written by a human. The problem is that they don't really like either because they tend to be pretty boring stories. But certainly we see the proponents of this really pushing this as sort of the next wave of technology. Another one is the use of metrics. So I'm talking about audience metrics as feedback for journalism organizations and what they get from the data. And here we have questions of journalistic judgment. You know, news has always relied on different arguments that journalists make about what's most important, where things should be placed, instinct, gut feeling, maybe drawing on a few people. Now we have data, and we can say this many people have read the story, this many people did not. We can test different headlines out, see which one gets more clicks. And what's happened is this is seen as a more objective measure of an audience than pre-existing ideas. But of course, we're only measuring certain things, right? We can only measure clicks, time spent. We can't really measure what people are reacting to beyond that. We have to stick with what we have. And this raises all kinds of questions about, is this feedback better? Should we cater what the audience wants, or is journalistic judgment still really important? In a way, we're talking again about objectivity and subjectivity. Okay, so the last paper part I want to talk about is distribution and circulation. And I'm going to talk about this from the idea of epistemology, right? So part of what's going on, I think there's a real renewed sense and interest in how news knowledge works. We're seeing more and more scholarship about this. But my argument is that what actual news looks like and how it's put together hasn't changed all that much, right? Even the automated journalism stories I was just talking about are meant to look exactly like what news has looked like for a very long time. There's probably more. I'm probably being a little pat here, and people who study this have other things to say, but I'm going to try to push our attention to what's occurred in the context of news circulation, right? And here I'm using Mats Ekstrom and Oscar's idea of the dislocation of the news journalism, right? This idea that journalism exists now in a communicative universe where it competes with a lot of different kinds of texts. It is thrown into this universe. It's very different than it was not that long ago. And so the question I think for us is, what is the social setting of digital news? Not just the news text itself and how it's produced, but once it leaves, I guess, the newsroom in a way, what is the setting of that? And how does that affect how news as knowledge works? So the divide here is between distribution and circulation. I'm borrowing this from Henry Jenkins, who talks about this in his book, Spreadable Media, and he's talking more about media in general, not just journalism, and really not about journalism at all. But the division he makes here is really useful. The distribution is really about mass communication models. The information travels from the center, from the newsroom, from the broadcast center, out to the public. Right. This is a classic model, and one that still exists in terms of how we think about news production. And this is different than circulation. Now, circulation gets used, like newspapers talk about circulation, but they're really talking about distribution in this model. I'm trying to use circulation as this more messy way of how messages travel in all different directions, right? If distribution is kind of from the center out, circulation's all across different kinds of channels, and it gets really complex really fast. So as a way of trying to explain this, I try to think about different aspects of it. Certainly this is about technology, the digital aspects. Digital media makes it possible to spread media in different ways, that people have a greater role. Discursive, right? What does it mean to share media? What does it mean to share content? What does it mean? How do we comment on things? How do we like and dislike and promote and not promote things? It's contextual in that we can't think about any news text, I think, by itself. We have to think about that news text and how it's going to move about the public. We can't just end with the text itself. And this is more than just media reception studies. We've had decades and decades and decades about media reception and sort of the active audience. But we need to also think about media reception within institutionalized flows, within the technologies that enable or constrain how these messages move. We can talk about circulation in different ways. I'm going to talk about it just in the digital sense and how these things are changing. So why does this matter? Why am I making a big deal about this? The argument I would say is that if we want to understand epistemic authority, if we want to really understand how news works as knowledge, we need to understand what the practices of modern contemporary circulation looks like in these digital settings. And here I'm drawing from Henrik Bødker's work about circulation, and he's looking at sort of like how, for instance, news texts circulate in different ways and what that means. And I like it because he has two different things here. He's talking about circulation as processes, as the way that technology works, but also about meaning. And here I'm going to go back to James Carey as an American scholar. We all talk about James Carey all the time because a lot of things he said a long time ago are actually really useful today. And he famously talks about communication as transmission versus ritual. One view is transmission, that we transmit information from one to the other. Circulation allows us to transmit information in new ways. But he also talks about communication as ritual, as a way of reproducing the world and meanings in the world and shared allegiances and understandings. And I think that's a really important part that Henrik gets here when he's talking about the production of meaning and cultures with circulation. Not just, hey, here's a message from one person to another. What's the meaning behind that sharing of messages? So three components of digital circulation to get through. Trying to bring order to this chaotic world, and my idea is to break it down to these three things. I'm sure there's other ways of doing this. Infrastructure, circulation practices, and epistemic contests. I think over the revising of this article, I went through so many different iterations of how to split things up until finally coming upon these three. And I think infrastructure, right? So first of all, we need to have this digital infrastructure that enables circulation to happen, that enables digital objects to be really easily shared, right? Easy to take a picture of the slide and send it off to everybody. It's not even that amazing anymore. But it is amazing, right? That we can just take a picture, put it on Twitter, and then everybody in the world can see it. I don't think most people are going to, but they could, potentially. It can go viral.
Share it without
Amina. There you go. So once Alf gets it around to the world, it's because everybody sees it. And there's some things here that are happening that I don't think we paid enough attention to. First of all, is the unbundling of media content, right? This was never possible. The news broadcast was the broadcast. We have to tune in and get everything on the radio and television. The newspaper is a newspaper, the magazine is a magazine. It is a vessel, and the ordering of news matters within this, right? A newspaper is very clear about what's the most important things and what things are less important, right? But now news stories are able to circulate independent of them. That story the newspaper thought was important, you might not care about at all, but something on the back page you see is really important, and you can make that important by sharing it. You're giving it different kinds of meaning. You're unbundling it and giving it different meaning. Even that, now we can even take pieces of news stories. We tweet out a line from a story. So we're unbundling within and taking little bits and sharing them and giving them new meaning, right? We have a lot more news available. This is one of the things that I always think I try to explain to my students, like my undergraduate students, is just imagine what it was like when you had a newspaper and you had to wait the next day to find anything else out, right? Maybe you can go to the library and try to research stuff. Nobody did that. We had a very finite amount of news. What was on television? What was in the newspaper? And then you wait. And now, of course, we have access to all these kinds of things, right? For me to read a news site in Norway is not strange at all in the U.S., except I don't know Norwegian. But technically, it doesn't even, you don't bat an eye. But if you think about how amazing that is, we see that these differences are happening. The role of algorithms, bringing algorithms back in, as, again, we have all this data, we have all these different systems. Algorithms sort through. They're one way by which circulation is altered. Because we have algorithms to sort things out for us. You can use Google News instead of using a newspaper. And I've already talked about audience measurement as also part of this digital thing. So all of this relies on this really complex infrastructure that's so ordinary to us now that we fail to see just how amazing it is. So what do we do with it? So now that we have this infrastructure, what happens? And here I'm talking about circulation practices, right? So from infrastructure to what this does for, say, news use. One idea I really like is from Ike Bocconi and his colleagues, the small acts of engagement, right? So it's not just large ways that people, you know, I'm going to write a 10,000 word blog post to respond to this. It's the liking, the clicking the like button or the dislike button, right? It's the small things we do. I hit retweet, right? Those are what he calls small acts of engagement that affect the circulation of news stories. News sharing, you know, people always share news, but it's always very difficult. You can cut out a newspaper story and send it to somebody, right? That was hard to do. My father-in-law still does that. He saves like a news story and we're like, you're like, I read this thing 6 months ago. Here you go. And he'll give it to me at like Christmas. But for a lot of this stuff, it's really easy to do this with the technological system. So what is news sharing like? What does this affect news knowledge? Right? Because now we're getting the news story from somebody, let's say, and there's some meaning attached to that about why they want to promote it. Do they like it? Do they hate it? Do they think it's important? Of course, mobile media too, right? In the sense that now news is everywhere, and you know when we're waiting in line in any sort of queue at all, right, for more than 5 seconds, we're going to pull our phone out, and we do a lot of things on our phones, but news is one of them. And the research on this, the empirical research so far, is finding that what's happening with mobile news is that some people, a small group, are really into news and digest it everywhere all the time. But the majority of people have this kind of light interaction with news. They just sort of absorb a little bits of it here and there. And far less thoroughly than they used to. And the research on here is a little depressing. We'll see how it happens in the future. This is all pretty new. But how we experience news is changing. And, you know, part of it is people now expose news when they're not really looking for it, but it finds them, right? There's this idea of the news finds me perceptions that people have been writing about that I don't need to follow the news because if it's important enough, I'll hear about it and I'll read about it. Some optimism, that's true. Some positives, some ways that people do discover things but they wouldn't. In other ways, the people who have the news find me perceptions are... Some of the data shows they're not as informed as other people are. I mean, it's not too surprising. But these circulation practices are all shifting. And then the third category I wanted to go beyond just how things are shared to how it leads to what I'm calling epistemic contests, right? Borrowing again from Thomas Guerin's work. What kinds of knowledge practices should we ought to have or not ought to have, right? We have these very normative questions because circulation allows for, digital circulation, for more voices to be active in more different kinds of ways. We can see contestation about what kinds of news, what kinds of practices are allowed and what's not allowed, right? So we have more, what I'm saying, epistemic approaches to news, more ways of telling news stories than we had in the past because the barrier is lower to getting news story out there. Doesn't mean that everyone's reading them, but the production of news and the ways of sharing them are really important. And of course, we see this in media criticism. Overt questions about how news works. And we see this in a lot of different places. So Donald Trump, famously in the U.S., spends a lot of time bashing journalists on his Twitter almost every day. He's called journalists the enemy of the people more than 40 times on Twitter, right? Not just like, I don't like journalists, the enemy of the people. That's happening through these kinds of circulation channels where the news stories are circulating, and alongside Donald Trump calling the press the enemy of the people. That's a very complex epistemological question about what all this means. But non-elites, and I think that's the important thing, back to Bocconi's idea of these active engagements. It's not just the president, it's lots of other people. People retweeting the president, calling the press the enemy of the people. If you haven't had this pleasure, go read the responses to Donald Trump's tweets. They're amazing. There's such a strange mix of like burn in hell or like go Trump go, and like they're just amazing. So we have the spaces for non-elites to be able to get in there. We have these interesting hybrid spaces, article comments, right? If you're brave enough to read those too, are these interesting hybrid spaces hosted by news organizations, but allowing for people to put their opinion in there. That's part of, I'm pulling that into circulation and part of the different ways people can respond to news. So when we think about, when we push beyond just the news story in the newsroom to how these things circulate, we're really paying attention to the social character of news, that news exists out in the world, right? And it helps move our idea of how news works as knowledge beyond just the news text itself and to how these things flow around. And I think it makes journalistic authority much more complex. If you think about journalistic authority as relationships, which that's the position I advocate for, how news becomes legitimated, we have to understand how that shifts with circulation practices where people respond to news, they share news, they criticize news, all these different ways. Okay, so transitioning to what? So, lots of stuff I've thrown at you today. A couple things I want to take away. First of all, that we need to think about these as all related, right? Epistemology and knowledge is related to technology. Technology is constantly changing, and so epistemology is constantly changing. Authority, the relationships of authority are constantly changing. The objectivity-subjectivity divide, you know, in one sense we learn in classrooms, one of the things you learn is that you can say, oh, objectivity is dead. It's always an ideal because it can never really be truly... it can never really truly occur because human beings, etc. But we keep seeing the reinvigoration of this debate as technologies change. The lenses through which we think about this idea change. Distribution and circulation, right? How news gets around is also changing. New technologies make this change, and it forces us to confront how these things are, how journalism is changing on this front as well. So, if transition is constant, transition towards what? So, you know, yeah, I'm an academic. I talk in this sort of theoretical way a lot of this stuff. But if we think about what the major debates are right now about technology, not even just news, but really technology, a lot of them, I say, are really about journalistic authority, right? Can we trust images? Deep fakes is the newest sort of... thing to worry about, where we can use video to make fake videos that look real, sort of look real. Right now there's more concern about it than there's actual practice, but certainly an issue where we're seeing things. Can we trust algorithms? Since I, you know, even worked on that book, I think we see so much more pushback against algorithmic processing. Certainly in the U.S., there's been a lot of stories about, say, biases in use of algorithms for prison sentencing. How long should somebody go to prison? The idea was we can hope for the algorithm to give us an unbiased view, because judges can be biased, and even then, we're finding lots of problems there. And we certainly see that when we think about social media and how those kinds of algorithms work. Facebook, of course, is a huge target here. Can we trust what's shared, right? We've moved into this model where we don't just have a few people speaking to the rest of us. We can all speak in a way. We have fear of fake news, right? Either misinformation or disinformation, right? Of things that are not incorrect or things that are purposely not correct. This is a big deal in the United States during the 2016 election. It continues to be so as we get ready for our next year's election. Another big concern is, have we fragmented so much that we can't talk to each other? And that relates back to some of these other issues. We hear about media bubbles. We hear about fragmentation and the suggestion that we no longer have a shared culture that media gives us, also involving journalistic authority, right? All these issues are about the problems of how we, how things are changing and the concerns we have that they're not changing for the best. At the same time, we're not going to give up all these things, too. But we have to understand that the very nature of how information flows, how it works, who has power over it, is changing constantly, and so is journalistic authority. These relationships are always changing, and I think we see such more of an expansion of forms, right? There are more things available for us, more different kinds of forms. And I think what's interesting is that we have more involvement, and we seem to prize that. But more involvement also brings more challenges. And the question that we have is, when are these challenges good and when are they bad? I'm not trying to have this nostalgic. I don't have a nostalgic view that, and a lot of people do, like we were way better off when we had a few channels of information controlled by professional journalists and everything was better. That's a fallacy of a golden age thinking. But at the same time, when are these kinds of new developments good and when are they bad? I think that's a really hard thing to do. It's easy to describe these processes. It's hard to give them a normative judgment about how they're working. But I think we really need to pay attention to changing structures. But I always want to get us back to how we imagine what journalism is, right? Journalism is something we imagine. We imagine it together. We imagine what it should be and what it's not. And it's always related to structures. But it's not exactly the same thing. And I think this dynamic is one that we have to pay attention to. And I guess what I'm saying here, too, is we need to look beyond the newsroom to understand journalism. We need to understand technologies. We need to understand audiences and how these things work together. And that's really the challenge that we have as scholars thinking about journalism. Thank you.